This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of August 20th, here are some top stories. In the news,
the wastewater from your shower, washing machine, and bathroom sinks is known as gray water. And in January, the rules on how to reuse this water changed. KJZZ listener Rebecca Smith-Kevern wondered why there are laws against drinking this water. And KJZZ's Claire Caulfield looked into it.
The main reason why you shouldn't drink gray water is because it can make you sick.
So if you wash your hands, you've made a deliberate effort to put bad stuff off of your hands that you don't want coming back into your body.
That's Dave Dunaway, who oversees water reuse for the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. The department does encourage some reuse of gray water, like in drip irrigation for gardens and lawns. The new law means you don't need a permit to use it at home, but you do have to follow rules, like only using it if a groundwater source is more than 5 feet below the surface and ensuring it stays on your property. Claire Caulfield, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And the story came to us from KJZZ listener Rebecca Smith-Kevern via qaz.kjzz.org.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Steve Goldstein.
If you ever watch over-the-air television or surf to any number of websites, the campaign ads are coming at you from the left and the right and sometimes the center.
We have the desert in our blood. Arizonans are strong and independent.
Arizona born. Kyrsten Sinema.
We love our country. We're skeptical of our government.
Securing our border isn't just about illegal immigration. It's about stopping dangerous drugs, illegal weapons, and human trafficking. It's about protecting our communities. President Trump is committed to building the wall, but many in Congress don't share this commitment, including my opponents.
They illegally cross our border. Criminals, violent gang members, and drugs, putting us all at risk. Representatives Martha McSally and David.
But the ads we've gotten so used to invading our space wouldn't have been possible without this groundbreaker from President Lyndon Johnson's 1964 campaign against Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater.
8, 9, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
Robert Mann is a professor of communications at LSU and wrote a book about that LBJ ad called Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds. And he's with me to talk about the ad and the dramatic changes we've seen since then in the business of convincing us which way to vote. Bob, why was that LBJ ad from 1964 so significant, even though it only ran one time?
Well, that ad was transformational, and it wasn't so much that it had a huge impact on the presidential race of 1964, because Lyndon Johnson was going to win no matter what he did on television in the way of advertising. But the ad transformed the ad and the other ads that Doyle Dane Burnback prepared for Johnson in 1964 transformed the way that politicians thought about political advertising. It turned it from a very rational, fact-based presentation of the candidates' positions or policies, many times 30-minute long speeches, in fact, into a very short appeal to the emotions. And it really showed politicians that they had been doing it wrong, and that they had not really understood the television medium.
People often bring up Citizens United, but we've seen the real expansion of those IEGs, those independent expenditure groups. How much has that changed what you're seeing in terms of ads, in terms of the fact there may not necessarily be advocating for a candidate, but there's a point of view that's very clear there?
I mean, it's the Wild West now. I mean, it's just a completely different environment than we saw until very recently. Just about anybody can get into the business legally. But I think maybe more important is, or more significant, is just the barriers to producing these TV spots and disseminating them have just collapsed. I mean, a good example is Beto O'Rourke, who has a very good media consultant producing his ads. has a spot up right now that was produced entirely on using iPhone video. The cost of getting into the business of producing ads is now the cost of getting a cheap video camera that in many cases are almost broadcast quality, and you're in the business. You can do a lot of harm or you can do a lot of good.
We still see TV ads, even though it's a non-presidential election year. We have a major U.S. Senate race here in Arizona. We're seeing ads every night from both the Republican candidates and then the Democratic perceived frontrunner. But I know there's been a lot more going on in terms of YouTube, in terms of social media. How do you think that has impacted either the message or the way people get the message?
Well, the difference there is that, you know, what you're seeing on television, the broadcast, and even cable, really is broadcast. It's to a broader audience. It is targeted in a sense because the people, the candidates and their media buyers know generally the profile of the people who are watching these particular shows, but it's still a broadcasting of that message. What we're seeing now on social media, on the internet, is the narrow casting of these messages. And we all know, we're all well aware of how much of our data is out there and how Facebook and other marketers have that information, and they use that information to send messages to me that someone sitting in the cubicle next to me maybe on the same website would not see because that person is not a target of that message. And so the ability of these advertisers to narrow cast is so much more sophisticated, and it's only getting more and more sophisticated. And the nefarious part of it is, the one thing about broadcasting a message is that since everybody sees it, including the press, you got to be a little more careful about what you say. You can't be, you know, you got to hew to the facts. You can't be racist or too racist. You got to, you know, there are some norms that you have to observe. In the narrow casting world, you can get away with a lot more because, you know, only the people who want to see it are actually seeing it, and it may be that stuff never really gets out into the broader world.
I was thinking about high-efficacy voters, and I think naturally maybe the assumption is that high-efficacy voters are people who are more informed, but maybe they're just more passionate about their candidate or their particular party, and they sort of vote the same way. When it comes to actually being an informed voter, coming back to talking about campaign ads, how much of an influence do campaign ads have today? If we get away from some of the narrow casting we talked about, if the traditional TV ad, do you think it's more of a reinforcement of what someone already believes, or can they be influential and persuasive, whether for good or bad?
Well, I think that is, you have hit upon, I think, what is the essential question about political advertising, and that is it effective? And if it is effective, who is it effective with? And that's one of the things that I always talk about with my students when I'm teaching about campaigns. And a couple of years ago during the presidential election, but we took the 11 battleground states that the candidates were fighting over, and we estimated that there were 4 to 5%, an average of 4 to 5% undecided voters in those 11 states. And then we took all the money that the candidates were spending on political advertising in those 11 states, which was, you know, hundreds, perhaps $1 billion over the life of the campaign. When you look at the obscene amount of money that the candidates are using to influence a very small percentage of the electorate, it makes you wonder if that really is the best way to reach the voters. I mean, you could afford to send a campaign worker to every one of their homes and take them out for coffee for the price that they're using for these ads. I think the premise of your question is that, you know, the 95% of the voters enter the election season already knowing who they're going to vote for, because they're either solidly in the Democratic fold or solidly in the Republican fold. And we're spending billions and billions of dollars trying to influence, you know, 5 to 10% of the electorate. And it just seems like a really inefficient way to do it when these candidates are broadcasting, not narrowcasting, but broadcasting these spots, spending hundreds of millions of dollars to do it.
Robert Mann is a professor at Louisiana State University. He's also the author of the book Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds, LBJ, Barry Goldwater, and the Ad That Changed American Politics. Bob, thanks for the time this morning.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Steve.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Business Desk, when an inmate is released from prison, immediate priorities include finding a place to eat and sleep. Support is crucial for this population, and without it, the chance of going back into prison skyrockets. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports on a local egg company housing employees who just came out of the criminal justice system.
an employee at Hickman's Family Farms drills into a wall where a new air conditioning unit is going to be. It's part of a new housing program for former inmates, who Hickman's has long employed as a solution to the agricultural industry's labor challenges. Chief Operating Officer Billy Hickman says the housing program grew from a brainstorm session about how to expand on the company's existing contract with the Department of Corrections.
So this is sort of over the years morphed into this, and so we finally decided that it was time to build these apartments.
So far, Hickman's has spent about $2 million to build 40 units in long concrete rows in the desert. There's a laundry room, and each 400-square-foot apartment comes with a full bath, something resident Nancy Carey does not take for granted.
I love coming home and taking a bath, but I want to take a bath, you know. When you're in prison, that's the first thing you want to do is take a bath.
Carey came out of prison for the second time recently. She says after her husband and brother died in the same year, her life spiraled into a series of poor decisions that led to her arrest. While in prison, she worked at Hickman's through the company's inmate work program. After she got out, she immediately applied for this housing, something she says meets her needs better than the halfway house she lived at before.
This is going to get me going, get me set, you know, get me for my future goals.
Her next goal is to get a car so she can visit her children more often. For Billy Hickman, that's the kind of return he's hoping to see.
I've been asked that before. How do you figure the payback? And there is no monetary payback on this.
The company keeps 20% of the employees' pay to help cover the costs of the housing, which is not limited to former inmates. At most, that adds up to about $400 a month. If they leave the housing after a full year, they get 50% of that money back.
Yeah, we met the other day.
I just didn't know if you recognized where that bug
was. Hickman greets Patricia Payton, who is sitting outside one of the squat brown buildings. She also just came out of prison for the second time.
Stayed out for 98 days, and then I was re-put back in prison for 6 more months, finished my number, and then I came here.
Payton had no home when she came out of prison both times, and practically nothing to her name. Now she has a home and a full-time job cleaning the machines where the eggs get processed. It's that kind of support that many formerly incarcerated people need, says Allison Wilkie with the Prisoner Reentry Institute at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York.
Housing is really a platform for opportunity. It's a platform for people to stay out of the criminal justice system.
Wilkie hadn't heard of a program like Hickman's, where a company provides housing directly for its employees if they've been incarcerated. But she explains what it takes to be successful.
If a program provides a real opportunity for people to stabilize their lives, to have access to some income, to have access to safe housing, and to get on their feet and move forward, then that's a great program.
Hickman's reentry manager, Aaron Cheatham, says the company is providing meaningful support.
They see a company putting an investment in them, and it makes their investment in themselves grow exponentially.
Cheatham was previously a state corrections and parole officer.
Never in a million years would I have thought I'd be at an egg farm.
But at Hickman's, Cheatham feels he's directly impacting lives by visiting the prisons 3 times a month to talk about the housing program.
They see that they're off to an awesome head start, but they also see what they could possibly be giving up if they were to, you know, go back to that life.
The first tenant moved in June 4th, and there are still about 20 units to fill. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Arlington.
From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein with a discussion of education deserts.
Earning a college degree is still a vital way to achieve career advancement, and not having one leads to making a lot less money over the course of one's work life. And there have been federal and state efforts to offer more higher educational opportunities. But that has still left many so-called education deserts across the country. With me to talk more about those and what can be done to improve the situation is Laurel Espinoza, an assistant vice president at the American Council on Education. Laurel, many people have heard of food deserts. Can you define education deserts for me?
So the definition of an education desert varies, but it is essentially a place where college options are limited. For example, having only one open access campus nearby or having only one or two four-year schools. And, you know, it's great having a highly selective campus in your neighborhood, but what if you're not qualified to go there or can't afford it? So the concept is really that your options are limited. And when we think about how students choose college, it's not in the classical way that we often discuss, where, you know, a student and their family do research, they visit campuses, The student might move away from home to go to college. In actuality, most students stay near their home. So when we think about how students actually choose college today, and we think about what's available to them, that's where we get to this role of geography. And geography is a powerful point of conversation in the education deserts concept.
And geography both in the sense of where in the country someone may be and then where in a particular state they may be. So if they're living, let's say, in the Midwest or in a rural area in the Midwest, are there some other things that come to mind? I mean, am I on the right track with that?
Yeah, I think you are. Yeah, I think, you know, the concept of education deserts, it does vary by who's discussing it, where they're located, what they're focused on. But you're right. It's about students that live in places in the country, whether they be rural or in places where commuting, you know, takes a long time to get to from point A to point B to go to school. But you can also have deserts in urban areas where there's just not enough open access institutions. So you might be a student that doesn't qualify for the selective institutions in your area, and that means that your options are limited in that way as well.
Well, let's talk about the sort of education options that are available. Community colleges, we have the traditional private colleges, traditional public colleges. We also have vocational schools, too. How difficult is it to counter your circumstances, I guess? Are there enough opportunities? Is there enough information out there? So if people had the access, they could be able to attend?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I mean, I think one thing we talk about in this conversation around education deserts is, where do people get their information? Where do they get guidance on where to go to school? And, you know, we think about this process whereby students have counseling and they have families that give them information and they know where to go for resources and guidance. And the reality for many students is that they're first generation to college, they're from low-income backgrounds, they don't have robust resources at their school. And so, you know, where they get their information really varies. They're not necessarily going to websites or seeking out the resources that exist. They're going often by what they hear around school or what they might hear from members of their family or in their community. And so this concept that people are equipped always with information is actually quite false. And it's also true that that's not necessarily how students choose school, even if they know where the information exists. They might think, well, that's great that there's a school 100 miles from here, but I can't leave my family. I have children. I have a full-time job. You know, I have close ties to my community. And so it comes down to what's convenient. And what is convenient is not always of the highest quality in some cases. It may be true that they don't qualify for a local school because it's selective, or it may be that they want to go into a field that the school nearby doesn't offer. So it ends up being quite limiting depending on where you live.
And in terms of finances as well, are we talking about the, obviously student loans can really weigh people down. We're seeing, of course, the issues with the for-profit colleges, which may be offered opportunities, but then people were up to their ears in debt for many years after that.
Right, right. And so I think that's also an interesting point when we talk about deserts is, what is the cost of the options nearby? And in some cases, the cost is not realistic for students, or they might be taking on loans that are at a level that they're just not comfortable with, and to your point, may leave without ever finishing and leave with a high debt burden and not a lot of options for employment.
So as we try to fight back against education deserts, I imagine technology comes into play to some extent. What are some ideas that, if they were implemented, could make at least some difference?
Technology, of course, is not a panacea. We often talk about distance learning or online learning. Some people say, well, maybe that's a solution for these deserts. But the truth is, that also means that you need to have learners that have access to broadband internet, people that, you know, have a good setup for that kind of learning. And frankly, not everybody learns the best in that way, and not all fields are taught best in that way. I think the jury is still out on just the power of online connectivity around education. But beyond, you know, beyond that intervention, which might work for some people, I think policymakers can help institutions that are already located in remote areas expand or add other degree options. For example, many community colleges are experimenting with four-year degree options. Or it could be that policymakers could help design incentives for more selective institutions in education deserts to partner with community colleges and expand that transfer pipeline, or offer other types of of resources to students in the area that will help them reach their educational goals.
Laurel Espinoza is an assistant vice president at the American Council on Education.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras desk, here's KJZZ's Kendall Blust in our Hermosillo, Mexico bureau.
A new study out this week shows that U.S. exports of natural gas to Mexico are at an all-time high and continuing to increase, even while pipeline construction has faced delays. Arizona, California, and especially southern Texas are exporting about 3 times as much natural gas to Mexico as they were a decade ago. That translated to more than $2.6 billion of natural gas exports in 2017. Exports totaled less than half of that just 8 years ago.
Very dramatic increase, and it's going to continue.
That's Victoria Zarietska. She's a lead economist with the U.S. Energy Information Administration and author of the new report. She says the upward trend slowed in the past 2 years as pipeline construction stalled in Mexico, mostly because of conflict with indigenous groups who contest the pipeline routes. That's been the case with the Yaqui tribe in the state of Sonora. But Zarietska says several of the pipelines are expected to come online by the end of the year anyway, and the market for natural gas in Mexico continues to grow. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
From the Arizona Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis.
Measles cases have reached record highs in Europe, as experts are raising concerns about resurgences of whooping cough and mumps. Now, new research reports that internet bots and Russian trolls may be weaponizing anti-vaccination messages on Twitter. Why do half of the tweets about immunizations argue against vaccination when a Pew survey reports the vast majority of Americans support it? The study found one possible reason, a rogues gallery of fake accounts, sophisticated bots, and state-sponsored Russian trolls tweeting about vaccination at high rates, fostering doubt and discord, but also driving clicks to inflammatory material and malware. David Broniatowski of George Washington University led the study. He says that, as with spam emails, users need to focus on the dubious source, not the content.
You want to shine light on that and warn people about that, rather than trying to argue, oh, all that anti-vaccine stuff is not true, because if that's what you do, you're kind of missing the point.
The study appears in the American Journal of Public Health. I'm Nicholas Gerbis in Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.